Accession number 30078, reel 3.
Patrick Emerson, reel 3.
So he said, well, look, you must have leave, and the only place to go is Calcutta. There is no other place, so off I went. So I checked in at the Grand Hotel, which sounds very nice. It was the biggest hotel there. Nice little room. Unfortunately, down below me was the nightclub, and they had just received the tune Down Mexico Way, and it played night after night and hour after hour, and it came straight up into my bedroom, all I could think of. And I went out, and I saw this great big Calcutta Memorial, Victoria Memorial, on the Maidan, which is the open area, and I thought, well, I must go and look in that. And when I walked in, I saw a great big plan laid out, original plan of Sir William Emerson. I said, that's funny, that's my great uncle. What's he got to do with this? Because I didn't know my father having died when I was so young. So I went up to one of the offices and said, by the way, I see you've got Sir William Emerson there. And they said, oh yes, he was the architect of this place. I said, well, I happen to be his grandnephew. Oh, come in. And I was given a Lord's tour around the building, up on the roof and everywhere. They really gave me a fantastic tour around the place. And I learned then, actually, that my father had been the civil engineer. He worked in my great-uncle's office, who'd done, I don't know if you've ever seen the picture, but there's a big golden angel on top, and it actually turns with the wind. And he had done that part of it, the civil engineering of the ball and the turning and everything else. So I was able to show off a little bit. So I do have a feeling for Calcutta because of that. And then I did the usual wandering around, looked at everything. And then being a young and healthy man with the correct idea on life, I said, where's Corio Road, where all the brothels are? And they said, oh, yes, that's a wonderful place. You must go down there. So down I went in a taxi. And it was a road with lovely bungalows, all dotted along, with nice gardens. And you went in, and they were all stocked with European women from every country you could think of. And I've always been a great believer in sex since I was introduced to it in Paris when I was a bit younger. And I met a really nice, charming Viennese woman amongst the group there and had a wonderful evening. The next evening, I was lying on my bed in my room, and Calcutta's really sticky. I was trying to sort of, feel like this, when there was a knock on the door. Door opened, and there she was. And she said, I've come to have supper with you. I said, yes, so let me dress. So I got dressed in that. We went down to Firpo's, the famous restaurant there. And I walked in very proudly with her and suddenly thought, oh, God, I wonder how many other people have been with her and know what she is. Anyhow, we had a wonderful meal. Came back to my room, enjoyed ourselves, and when she went home, and I thoroughly enjoyed my leave that way.
Was there any sort of formal procedure? Was there any sort of formality?
In what?
Well, in the visiting of the local brothels, was there a sort of standard?
Oh, no, there was no formality, and you went down by taxi, and you chose one of them and went in, and they were pleased to see you. But, as I say, they were nearly all European, and the madames were mostly European. And, of course, typically British Army, you never told anybody you'd been there. Probably everybody knew, but you'd never said, oh, I went down the brothel. Oh, disgusting, you know, this sort of thing. And they'd probably been down themselves. As a sideline to that, Madame Andre and Madame, I forget the name of the second one, they ran the biggest one in Calcutta, in Bombay, and it is said that they financed half the cost of the free French troops in India out of their goodness. I mean, they made a packet of money, especially once the war came and hundreds of Europeans came out. And attach a little story to that, if I may. My aunt, my father's sister, she had done the old Victorian thing of staying unmarried in order to look after her parents. They came back from Argentina when they were old and left cousins and things out there. Lived in London, and Auntie Lita looked after them, and then they died off. Now, Lita was left with a packet of money, and so she used to spend 6 months in Monte Carlo and 6 months in London, partly for tax purposes. Of course, if you are 6 months out of the country, you'll get away with it. Anyhow, later on, it comes in my story. Later on, I was in Monte Carlo, and I went up and visited her. I was working on a boat, so I was just in rough old sailor's clothes. And she was very good. She chatted away and gave me a lovely tea and everything, was pleased to see me. And she said, ah, we have a lady retired here who knows India. I'll call her. And she rang down to another flat. And up came this lady who looked at me and sort of, I think I know him. And I looked at her face and thought, sure, I've seen her somewhere. And she was Madame Andre's number two from the big brothel in Bombay. And she'd retired and was living in Monte Carlo. And I didn't tell my aunt that. My aunt said, oh, very nice woman indeed. Yes, she knows a lot about India. Hmm. Right.
Did the armies ignoring of that aspect mean that they didn't inform you of the risks involved?
No. You were meant to know. But you did know because you had to lecture the troops on the risks of venereal disease and everything. Now, the troops were not allowed to go down. They couldn't have gone to those brothels because they were expensive a bit. I mean, I was just able to get enough money together type of thing until this girl took a liking to me. God knows why. Troops were not meant to go to the brothel area. There were military police patrols around, but got there they did. And men got VD. I would go back a bit to the Lincolns. I was very shaken. Many even there managed to get VD. They got down to the village of Nasirabad, and there were some women available in that. And if a man got VD in those days, first of all, his pay was stopped because it was considered a self-imposed injury. Secondly, once he came out of hospital, he'd only been in for a few days, you used to get injections of sulfur and bismuth, one in each buttock. Painful as hell, like fire going in. And after that, they came back to their platoon, but every evening they were out with the defaulters in full dress, full battle dress, full pack, everything, and drilled like hell for an hour. In other words, a heck of a punishment. And that went on for about a month. So it wasn't all that fun getting VD. But you see, there used to be originally in India brothels laid on for the troops, which personally I think is a very wise idea because you can control it. But the story goes that one of the viceroy's wives, and I can't remember which one, heard about it and was horrified and disgusted and prevailed upon her husband to have it all cancelled. That men mustn't be allowed to do that thing, it mustn't be told it's a good thing and so on. So men then had to go off and find what they could. Well, of course, when you go off and find what you can, the people you find are people who don't usually keep themselves awfully clean, or they don't know about the illnesses in many cases. So, of course, VD was not rampant, but it wasn't unknown. And troops, in a way, had a bad way. In that way, they'd either abuse themselves or be good and saintly, one or the other. Anyhow, I came back from that 10 days leave, and then another CO was appointed, Colonel Osborne, and Malcolm Gracie stayed there for a little while, not commanding or doing anything. He handed over, and then he was sort of having it quiet for a little while, I think while they were looking for a posting. And then he got a posting as a military advisor to the Maharaja of Bhopal. Now, another sideline. Later in my life, I was in the Australian Army, and I noticed that the Dean of Sydney Cathedral was the very, very Reverend General Osborne. I thought, well, that's funny that it should be like that. So I went up to a service, not to attend the service, but to see him, really. And I caught him on the side, and it was him. I knew the face straight away. And we corresponded, funnily enough, even after I came back to England for some years. And in the correspondence, he did slowly let on to me that he came from the Sikh battalion, not a grenadier at all. He was sent to the battalion to chase it up a bit because it was said that under Gracie there was an awful lot of nepotism going on. And some of the subedars were appointing people from their village to ranks and all this was going on. Now, I never knew that. To me, it seemed to be a very happy little battalion. But then, after all, I'd only been there 2 or 3 months. I hadn't a clue. So Osborne came, and then just after Christmas, we had the order to move right down the bottom of India to St. Thomas's Mount next to Madras. So this was my first experience of a troop train, Indian troop train. On the morning of our departure, the next relieving regiment came in. They were a Gurkha battalion, the first time I'd seen Gurkhas. My God, they were impressive. They were so smart and clean and so soldier-like in everything they did. I was most impressed by them. My feeling towards Gurkhas has always been very high because of that. Now, we got on the train, and the troops are crushed in third class in wooden seats. How the hell they slept in that, I honestly don't know. We had first class carriages, which is usually four bunks and one officer per bunk. And the train went into Bombay, into Calcutta as the main terminal, and then set off all the way down the east coast of India, all the way down to Madras, which took 3 days. The way they used to feed was they would have regular stops, and they would get out, and the regimental cooks would cook up a meal, and the troops would sit there. And for officers, they would wire ahead to stations, and a meal would be ready there. We would all get off and have our meal there. Now, the poor old troops, meanwhile, up the line had been squatting on the hunkers, eating whatever there was. They got a proper Indian meal. I mean, it wasn't cut back, it was all their rations. But the train literally stopped for a couple of hours at that one spot. Then they'd stop at the station for us. It was boring, there was nothing to do. I was childish, and I prided myself in climbing along the outside of the carriages to get to the next carriage and so on. Got thoroughly ticked off for it. But it was an adventure for me. Dunlop did the same too. The two of us did, the two junior second lieutenants. We going along like monkeys along the carriage. Seal happened to look out one day, and that was it. And we got to St. Thomas's Mount. Now, this was completely and utterly different from memory station. I knew it was about, I don't know, it's 6 to 10 miles outside of Madras. It's a military station, but no barbed wire around it or anything like that. It's purely a military station. There's a very big church there where the body of St. Thomas the Apostle is said to be. That's why it's called St. Thomas's Mount. He is reputed to have come to India, to the south, and then gone across to Madras and died there and was buried there. Now, whether that is true or not, I don't know, but there's a wonderful shrine. There's history going right back to the distant past, and there's that St. Thomas's Mount. And we were in barracks that had been built in the early 1800s. And to give you some idea, our mess hall was a small addition of the inside of St. Paul's Cathedral, went up in great big curves. And in fact, when we had our first mess night and the piper plays at the end around the table, Colonel Osborne said, "My God," he said, "I dreamt I dwelt in marble halls." It was like that. The sound drifted away into the ceiling and so on. The bungalows were much more modern. They were quite nice. Each officer, again, you were back to your normal ration of a sitting room, a little bedroom, a changing room, and a bathroom. And they were set out away from the main part of the troops, some way away, in a nice tree area and that. It was very, very comfortable. And Madras was about 20 minutes by car away. So we could get into Madras quite easily, and in the evenings we often went in. Being a loner, I went very much on my own. I'm afraid this has shaped my career, sometimes to my detriment of being a loner. But I know one famous thing is when Dunlop and Siv Wright and about four others went in, and at the Connemara Hotel, the entertainment at dinner was a trapeze team. These four had drunk enough, and they went up on the stage and pushed the team away and started bouncing up and down themselves, the great applause of the audience and everything. And that I stayed more on my own. I used to go to a fun fair. Maybe I'm childish. I used to go to a fun fair where they had the Dodgems, and I used to spend hours on the Dodgems. The trouble was, of course, I was the target for every Indian there on a Dodgem, and I got knocked to hell, but I thoroughly enjoyed myself. And through the allowance my mother gave me, I bought a motorbike. None of the officers had a car or a motorbike. We all used bicycles. Bicycle was a main movement inside the cantonments, all cantonments, bicycles. But I bought a motorbike and chuffed around a bit and went down to the beach and found out where to meet a couple of Anglo-Indian girls and things like that. And then a new CO came, Colonel Franklin. Osborne was on his way up. He became a major general. Later on, he became a full general, but he was on his way up. Franklin was the one who had been at Bombay on the staff who'd interviewed me at Nasirabad and said, well, might do. He was a man who could shoot you down with three words of sarcasm. He could be so sarcastic, he'd make you absolutely feel, you know, like that. And he took an instant dislike to me, and I took an instant dislike to him. You know how sometimes that happens. And I thought he picked on me two or three times. Once or twice, quite correct. I remember one time I came in from very early morning parade to breakfast, and I was covered in sweat. Okay, I should have gone and changed my shirt. I know I should have done, but I didn't. And he just looked up, and I forget what it was he said, but I felt so tiny in front of everybody, and, you know, sort of crawled out, and that sort of thing. I didn't like him. He was probably a pretty efficient officer, because he commanded the battalion after they moved, and when they were made the first motor battalion, which had never been in existence before, he was asked to write the pamphlet on motor battalions, but then of course he had to make it up out of his head. So they credited him with that they thought he was good enough to do that. Later the pamphlet was changed a lot with experience in Burma and things. So his dislike for me paid off, because by now it would be June or July 1940. The war then had been going 9 months to 10 months. And at first of all, Churchill had said, no, the Indian Army won't be required. But very quickly, when Dunkirk happened, and they could see the troubles occurring, they decided the Indian Army would have to be used once again. So we got the go-ahead, and of course, immediately there was a vast expansion. Expansion meant that many officers had to go up two or three ranks almost straight away and take over commands and things. When I was a second lieutenant, I was sent to Bareilly, which was the training center of the Grenadiers and the Jarts. The reason for that is that the Grenadiers had been cut back to just two battalions in 1922, when a big reorganization of the army was made after the war. And the Jarts were cut back to three battalions, and it was considered that two or three battalions didn't warrant a training center of their own. So they combined the Jart Grenadier Training Center into the 4th, 9th Training Regiment. This is the 4th Grenadiers, 9th Jarts. So I went up to Bareilly, which is in the United Provinces. It's a really nice station, a pretty good climate, pretty hot, but pretty good climate. Bungalows built in a roundabout, most of them in around about the 1920s. It's a very old station. It was very prominent in the Indian Mutiny, but there'd been a lot of rebuilding there. And I got a nice bungalow. Again, the usual living room, little sleeping room, bathroom and that, and a big garden at the back. And Hayat Khan, my bearer, got his family down from the frontier, and they had a little hut at the side where they could live. And I became the company officer of G1 Company. Now, G1 meant 1st Battalion Grenadiers. Each of the five different battalions would get a number, like G1 1st Grenadiers, G2 2nd Grenadiers, J1 1st Jarts, J2, J3. And so you only serviced your own battalion. So each of those companies would have had officers from their own battalions. So there was Major Hamlin commanding the company, and I was there as company officer, second lieutenant. Then, as I say, this terrific expansion occurred, and Major Hamlin, who had served in the First World War by virtue alone of his seniority, was whisked away to another job. They hadn't got a replacement, so they made me company commander. I immediately became the new rank of temporary captain, whereas all the lieutenants back at the First Fourth were still lieutenants. So Franklin helped me in that way, that I became a temporary captain long before anybody else. Sorry, acting captain. You had three lots of ranks. Acting, after 6 months you became temporary. After 6 months more, you became more substantive. But you only became a substantive person after you served your correct amount, which normally would be 8 years for a captain. So I became an acting captain, as I say, much earlier than anybody else. And I had G1 Company, it was entirely made up with training. We had to expand quite a bit in numbers, and it was a normal routine soldiers training. They came in straight from the village, completely jungly, knowing nothing, and you had to turn them out into a reasonably trained soldier. I can't remember the period. It might have been 9 months, I think they had. It may have even been shorter. There was a lot of work to do. It was a big mess. There must have been, must have been 20, 25 officers in the mess. There were a number of married officers living out, and it was a real old-fashioned mess, enormous rooms. It's the first time I've ever lived in a mess where, typically Scottish if you like, the walls are hung with hundreds of heads of deer and things, all that have been shot. It looked like to me a graveyard. I hated it, but it was a good mess, and you had billiard rooms. You were well looked after. Our first Anglo-Indian officer came while I was there, Vaughan. And before he came, there was a bit of snobbishness. Oh, God, Anglo-Indian officer's coming. Ugh. The younger people didn't worry very much. To us, it didn't mean a lot, but some of the older people. And when he came, he was quite a nice fellow. He did have a bit of snobbishness against him because Anglo-Indians were looked down upon. But he became a great favourite of mine because his father owned the transport company up at Nainital in the hills, and Vaughan had a car. So for me, he was a great friend. And actually, I got to know him well and went up to Nainital and stayed with his family and things like that. He was the first to come. Then we began to get one or two younger Indian officers. I don't think there's any particular reaction about them in that, it's got to be, they have to be Indians, there it is. But I'm sorry for them in that no concessions were made in the mess to them. Indian music was never played on the radio. It was always Delhi radio or Britain, something like that. There was never Indian music. If anybody did by chance put it on, you'd get some senior officer, what's that bloody noise going on? And also, we used to always have curry in the Indian Army on Thursdays. They kept to that, so they had European food for 6 days of the week and then curry on a Thursday. Looking back now, I think we could have been more liberal and we could have had either a choice of dish or we could have had more curry ourselves, because we all like curry. I think we were a little bit like that. There was one officer, Major Leonard, as I say, a major, which meant he would have had about 20 years' service. He was an Anglo-Indian, not terribly obvious, but he was, and it would be sort of whispered to you, oh, Major Norman, he's an Anglo-Indian. He had a charming Anglo-Indian wife, a really nice woman who was very, very capable. And amongst other things, she used to make her own dresses. And this, I've heard it actually said, oh, Mrs. Norman, she makes her own dresses, you know, with that sort of look, which unfortunately is what the feeling was around there. And yet they were two most charming people, and he was a highly efficient officer. You see, the average woman who wanted to have a dress, either they went on the holiday to the big towns, or more likely, there were dirzies, that's people working cloth and sewing. What do you call it? I can't think of the English word.
Tailor.
There were tailor dirzies who would go around with their machine and sit on your veranda and make your clothes for you. So women would have a dress made and that. But Mrs. Leonard, she makes her own dresses, you know. But she made bloody nice dresses too. She looked smashing in them. There was this little bit, I think even now people find a reluctance to admit it. But unfortunately, I bummed around the world so much that I know it happens. I've seen it in other countries with other nations and other things. And I've had some very, very good Anglo-Indian friends. And it's sad, but it existed. Right, so here we were at Bareilly.
Actually, did you at that stage, or could you at that stage, have any idea of what the general Indian attitude towards the war was?
Now you must remember that in the army we lived in a very tight enclave. We knew very little of the civilian side of life, very, very little indeed. In fact, if you did happen to try and speak in Urdu to a civilian on the station, he'd sort of be surprised. Say, oh, you speak Urdu, he would say. You know, there was that lack of meeting. One knew that there were certain groups against the war, Gandhi's lot and Nehru's lot and so on. But on the whole, we only worked with the villagers who wanted to be sepoys because they needed the money, and their families had been sepoys for years, and so as far as we were concerned, oh yes, good thing, the war, you know, let's join up. And of course we were expanding and taking on more people. So we had very, very little contact with the civilian side. While I'm being very personal, at Bareilly there was the Indian Military Hospital, IMH, and that was staffed by nurses of the Indian Medical Nursing Service, who, they were a lot of Anglo-Indians amongst them. I fell madly in love with one, frantically in love with her. Cried my eyes out one whole evening when she was posted to Egypt with the military hospital there. I'm still in contact with her. She was the sister of a colonel of mine who's still alive. He must be 94, lives over on the east of London, and she must be now 83. She married a British Army officer and came back to England, and it wasn't until I came back 30 years later that I raised and ran the Indian Army Association. The Colonel Hendricks was talking to me one day, he was a member, and I said, Hendricks, oh, I used to know a girl of that name. She's called Esme. He said, that's my sister. I said, oh, what happened to her? He said, oh, she's alive in Essex. So we write occasionally. Here, that's personal details for you. Well, one had to have some sort of entertainment, some sort of sex life, and so on. Anyhow, time moved on and expansion had to go. The Indian Army expanded, as you may know, up to 2.5 million. It was 1.5 million in the First World War, 2.5 million in the Second World War, the biggest volunteer army ever to exist in the history of the world. And there were volunteers too. It was then decided, well, we've got to expand, we must have more grenadier battalions, so we need more Jart battalions, so therefore we'll split the training centre and we'll have the Grenadier Regimental Training Centre and the Jart Regimental Training Centre. Well, the Jarts had always been at Bareilly, that was their hometown, and funnily enough, the Grenadiers had been at Nasirabad long, long before. 1920, I think their centre was there. So they said, well, the Grenadiers will go back to Nasirabad. It was like going home for me. And Hamlin was called in to be the commander of the centre, and as so often happens, he knew me because I'd been his company officer, and he said, right, Patrick, well, you be the adjutant. Move the men. So I had to move what then was basically two companies, but with a very, very large companies with all the extras and things, move them down back to Nasirabad. It really was like coming home. Now, Nasirabad had been closed just after I'd left for lack of water. It just ran out of water. In the meantime, they'd sunk three enormous artesian wells. And so it's on the edge of the desert, so it's a very dusty area, and they had to sink them really deep. And I think for those days it was really an engineering feat how deep they went. But they did get enough water. And so instead of bringing back, as they had before, the Raj Patana Rifles Training Centre who'd gone to Delhi, and the artillery from Mau, they put just the Grenadier Training Centre, and we took over the whole of Nasirabad cantonment, and we needed it all by the end. I think I took down about 1,200 men, and we expanded finally, I think, up to about 10,000. I went down as adjutant. I told you on more than one occasion I liked being a learner. I liked being adjutant because I was very much my own boss. As long as I kept Colonel Hamlin happy with the work and things that were being done, nobody was going to interfere with me. I set one or two odd regimes. I used to get to the office at 5 a.m. and work like hell on all the paper till about 8, have it all ready for the colonel, and then go and have my breakfast and take it easy in the mess. And when he came in about 9, it was already there. But I found that was an easier way of working, rather than me arrive with him at 9 and then have to scrabble through all the paper and everything, get it all ready and done. I stuck to myself very much. I've always been, as I stuck to myself very much. people still, I mean, the ones who are alive still said, oh, well, you were always on your own.